G'day. Indy Wood here. Welcome to The Local Update, a podcast looking at local issues and events taking place around the Bega Valley. On today's episode, we'll talk to Casey Hill from the Bega Multicultural Centre to look at how they are engaging multicultural community in a digital environment. The Local Update is brought to you by indiemedia.com.au, and you can find the podcast there. First up, though, we'll catch up, as we do each week, we'll catch up with Graham Farram from the Bega Pioneers Museum to look at what treasures he's found from the history collections of the museum.
I'm going to be reading from another library book today, a prose piece to kick us off. This is the Old Bulletin Reader. It was originally published by the Bulletin Newspaper Company in Sydney in 1901. This is just about a complete reprint, by the look of it, published in 1973 by Lansdowne Press. A little note in pencil here tells me that it was donated to Merimbula in the seventh month of 1987. A prose piece, and a little bit somber. I first ran across this when I was working with a friend. He was a presenter on Edge FM here, our local radio station. And at the time, we were investigating doctors who were also poets. And that's when I first ran across this little story in the Old Bulletin Reader. Now, the stories, they say, were published between 1881 and 1901. From what I know now, I think this is, you know, sort of around the turn of that 20th century to maybe just a little bit earlier than 1901. It's called A Martyr of No Account. We're on page 126. The sun looked down unwinkingly upon the rolling sand dunes covered with a scrubby undergrowth of mallee, tea tree and lianas. It looked searchingly and pitilessly down upon the rubble hut with its black tin roof and hessian substitutes for windows. The everlasting stiffened and curled in the fierce heat, and the earth sizzled and fumed. The sweat from the doctor's horse quivered into the baked atmosphere, and left streaks of acrid salt rolled down his heaving sides. No bird called. No insect hummed. The flies were clinging to the shady sides of the limestone boulders, and Sheol was in the air. Inside the hotel, all was as dark as a cellar and as close. There was the same stillness, save for the heavy breathing of the man and the woman and the children, all lying in one bed, smitten by the influenza bell. The atmosphere of the place was poison, fetid, stagnant, and charged with every foul human product. Only one person besides the doctor moved in the den, slowly and with mechanical languor. She was a girl of 19 or 20, it might have been good to look at, but for neglect and uncleanliness and the advanced signals of disease. Now and then the man ground his teeth and groaned voicelessly. The woman whined an occasional answer to a question from the doctor. And the children slept the sleep of Tom and In and carbonic acid gas. The girl stood listlessly at the foot of the iron bed, supporting herself, with both lean, horny hands clutching its rusty rail. "How long have you been down?" asked the doctor of the woman. "A week," she complained, "and he has been in bed for 4 days. Them," indicating the children, "all took bad 10 days ago." The doctor said little, but took temperatures, auscultated chests, and made entries in his notebook. It was was a monotonous proceeding, broken only when he went out for a pannikin of warm water from the galvanised tank to wash his thermometer. The man had the headache, little else of importance. The woman had the cough that is like the rending of the soul from the body, but again, little else of importance. The children had the deadly, helpless, hopeless sleep, from which they only awoke at intervals to moan and toss and complain and go to sleep again. Just then, the man roused himself to whimper, "There's something for this here pain in me head. It's driving me mad." The woman would never look through it another night if I don't get some relief from this cough. The children made no complaint. They slept and breathed tomains and carbonic dioxide, and the girl said nothing, but gazed at the doctor with a hazy, half-intelligent stare and gripped the iron bed rail harder, while her breath came and went in quick, irregular gas, and her nostrils moved like those of a winded hare. "Anyone to fetch out the medicine?" Perhaps a neighbour would if the doctor would ask. "Brandy? Yes. A little chicken broth? Yes. Violet Pearl would make that. Violet Pearl, go and get Jimmy a drink. Can't you hear him moving?" whined the woman in a grieved tone. And then, "The girl is that stupid and mazy-like. She ain't the least as good to nobody. And if it wasn't bad enough to be nigh unto death without having to worry because everything is as wanted." As the girl returned, stumbling over the uneven limestone floor, her father broke out, "For God's sake, Violet Pearl, how much longer are you going to let this handkerchief dry on the head? Where's the vinegar and water? Bring it out again, can't you?" "Sit down," said the doctor to her a moment later. "Let me have a look at your chest." Listlessly, she unfastened the dowdy calico bodice and bared her thin neck and shoulders, breathing a little harder, but not appearing much interested. "Hmm," said the doctor as he moved the end of the stethoscope here and there and tapped with his finger ends on her all too plainly visible ribs. And then a little later, temperature 104, pulse 120, left posterior base solid, he wrote in his notebook. And to the girl he added, "You must go to bed and stop there. If you don't do so now, you'll have to tomorrow, and then you may not get out of it again." A chorus came from the man and woman. "Lord sakes, doctor, what are you talking about? Who's to look after us?" "She's the only one that's fit to move. As for me," the woman continued, "I couldn't get up and do nothing, not if he was to pay me. And I'm sure he couldn't do nothing if he was to get up." The man groaned and said his head would come off if he were to move. And it was all nonsense talking to Violet Pearl laying up. She was always fancying she had something the matter with her. The doctor sighed and explained again, and at last lost his temper. "You good-for-nothing brute," he said, looking contemptuously at the man. "What the devil does your headache matter compared with this girl's chance of dying in 48 hours if she doesn't go to bed? She's 50 times worse than your wife here. And as for you, you're in no danger at all." Then he was sorry he'd lost his temper, because it was of no use. The man groaned, and the woman whined, and the children slept. And Violet Pearl smiled feebly and breathed a little faster and said she could get along all right till Auntie Emma came. Aunt Emma had promised to come the day after tomorrow. No one else would come because they were frightened of catching it themselves. And again the doctor sighed and then swore silently and rode away to arrange with the neighbour to take medicine to them. 2 days later he went again. The same baking heat. Same white glaring light from the sand beating on the frowsy Hessian and Suzy windows, and inside the same fetid smell and plague-stricken atmosphere. And at this time, the silence was broken by a few large yellow-bodied droning flies that boomed and buzzed about the room. The man was sitting up near the fireplace. The woman whimpered in a corner, seated on a kerosene box. The children slept on a shakedown of gunny sacks in another corner. And on the iron bed, covered by a coarse and dingy sheet which fell into hollows and stood starkly out in horrible, unmistakable ridges, lay something that had been Violet Pearl. She had got along all right until that morning. Then the poor, willing, helpful spirit had shaken itself free and left its partner. A man with the headache and the woman with a cough had unwillingly got up to attend to their wants themselves. That signed C.H. Suter, and with some help, I was able to look him up. Suter Charles Henry, 1864 to 1944, he died on the 20th of August in North Adelaide. This is from the Australian Dictionary of Biography by Vivian Smith, published in 1990 in volume 12 by the Melbourne University Press. I'll just sort of skim over this, but very, very well written, excellent piece of biography here. He was a medical practitioner and writer, born on the 11th of October 1864 in Aberdeen, Scotland, eldest son of John Clement Suter, general practitioner, and his wife Helen Neekoots. John, an accomplished pencil and watercolour artist, collected rare classical books and old English china and coins. Charles went to Highgate and University College schools, and at 14 registered as a medical student under his father's tuition at the Royal College of Surgeons. John brought his family to Sydney in March 1879, ship surgeon, clipper, city of Corinth. Charles enjoyed the voyage and gained a lifelong interest in ships and sailors' songs, worked on the family selection, became an expert horseman. In August 1882, he went to Scotland to study medicine at the University of Aberdeen. Sailed to Hong Kong as a ship's surgeon, made a number of coastal voyages, married twice. His first wife died in childbirth, leaving him a daughter. Second wife bore him a son. Practiced in South Australia, as did his father and brother. From 1896, he contributed to the bulletin, sometimes using the pseudonyms Neil and Dr. Neil, published four collections of verse between 1912 and 1935. His work is characterised by a gentle humanity. His poems of World War I are a notable contribution to writing in this field. He wrote ballads, shanties and poems, made a significant contribution to Australian writing. Served much of his time as a locum tenens, found the leisure to write and sketch, compose and play bush songs, bird calls and shanties on his harmonica and flute. Another of his pastimes was manufacturing ornaments, clock stands and jewel boxes from mallee root. And so he was a poet and a musician and a songwriter and a doctor. That was a rather stark and somber, pathetic story there from the bulletin. But I was able to find something a little bit more of gentle humanity, but still with a sting in its tail. This is called Harvest Time. Oh, and it mentions a German wagon, which, of course, we have at the Bega Pioneers Museum when you're able to come. It was used by the Porter family for many years before being donated to the museum, and it's a fine example of a German wagon. When the cranky German wagon, with its 10 or 15 bag on, comes a jerking and a jolting down the dusty limestone street, and the northers blowing blinding, and the rollers are a grinding, and the agent stabs his sampler through the sack and to the wheat. Let him slide along the plank, slide along, 60 bushels for the bank. Slide along. When your back is fairly breaking and your very fingers shaking with the heaving, heaving, heaving in the blasted blazing sun, and the agent finds the spots out and takes all his sample lots out where it's rusty, pinched or musty, knocking 5 pounds off a ton. flying, swing them over with a jerk, slide along, slide along. 60 days of wasted work, slide along. 60 days of ploughing Mallee in the godforsaken valley of the creep and crawl and Murray with the dingoes for your mate. Sow and harrow, roll and reap it, but you get no show to keep it, for it's boom and bust your boiler when the cocky speculates. Let the bankers take the lot. Slide along, slide along. Farming Mallee's bloom and rot. Slide along. To find some other of his poetry. I know I've got a book here somewhere. As I've been isolated, I've been finding lots of things in my own library. I've even had the pleasure of finding that I had two copies of one book and then two copies of another book another day. But that slide along, slide along, that would make a great song, and you can see people working to that. That could be a kind of shanty that you do the work to. But in the end, how much do you get for it? And I feel for our farmers, I'm so glad that we've had some rain, indigo. Oh, and the slide along reminded me of Henry Lawson's description when he was at the Tarthra Wharf waiting to go further north up to Sydney, and all the cheeses were being rolled down the chute into the waiting steamer, a machine. We're all big cogs in the machine. And at the moment, well, it seems that we're laying idle. Oh, well, there's so much can be done. I've been working in the garden. Oh, yes, I like the rain. It's very, very welcome. And certainly after the kind of start to the year that we've had, when people talk about, well, when will it be like February when it was normal again? Well, of course, February wasn't very normal here. And we've moved from drought and fire, flood, and now this pandemic. But I do advise people, stay home. Don't try and run away from this. Stay home. Get strength.
Absolutely. Do it properly. All right, Graham, thank you so much for your time again, and we'll catch you next week.
Thanks very much, Indigo.
See ya. Graham Farram is the former proprietor of Mumford's Books here in Bega. He's also an artist, a long-term community member, and has been involved with the Bega Pioneers Museum for a number of years. We catch up with him each week to check out what treasures he's found from his collection. In these times of COVID-19 isolation, we're all looking for new things to do with our time. How about the idea of learning a language with online language lessons run locally here in the Bega Valley? The Bega Multicultural Centre was opened about 6 months ago. Director Casey Hill tells me that running a community hub that's meant to bring people from cultures from all over the world together in one place in the Bega Valley gets very difficult in these isolation times. She says they've turned to the internet to try and address this.
My name is Casey Hill, and I am the liaison for the Bega Multicultural Centre.
Give me a bit of an overview. What's the Multicultural Centre about?
So basically, last year I was approached by Queen Bee and Multilingual Services. They had been running some MAGIC meetups. So MAGIC stands for Multicultural Activities Group in Community, and they were running those meetups at the Funhouse, the first Funhouse we had. So when they approached me after we had closed down our, you know, our old premise, they said that they wanted to pair up again and start another center. So a place where people could come and access the internet, but also where there we could hold activities from movie screenings to dance classes. So yeah, but we also offer services. So it's not just like a community center, which is kind of the Funhouse aspect. It's also, I'm now in a paid position where I can actually liaise with and support community, so newly arrived migrants and refugees in our community.
I'm interested, Casey. I think about growing up in this region, and as a kid I always had this impression that there was one Chinese family that ran the restaurant in the pub. There was a handful of, you know, a strong Indigenous community, and then it was just white fellas. So how much has that changed? How multicultural is this community?
Oh, well, look, just speaking from personal experience, you know, I myself am a migrant, but also just the people I've met since I've moved down, since I've been in the Bega Valley. It's overwhelming, to be honest with you. And that goes also beyond more recently arrived migrants. It's like, you know, you have Dutch families who've been in the area for over 50 years, or Vietnamese families. There's a strong Filipino population and a Thai population in the area as well. So multiculturalism is actually quite Australian. The Snowy Monero, so specifically in Cooma, they were called the was the home of multiculturalism in Australia, because they had a lot of migrants moving to work the hydro scheme. So, you know, it feels kind of new, and there's always people obviously coming, but I think this is actually, it goes back some time.
The isolation situation that we're in now, because of COVID-19, that must have a pretty strong impact on people who are new to this community and don't have any contacts. It must be quite isolating.
Look, that, you know, I've just started this role. So I began the role in October last year, and then we had the bushfire crisis, which was just unprecedented anyway. And then on top of that, now with this, with COVID-19, it's just, I'm really feeling for the community, because part of my job is to make sure there are opportunities for people to join together and to create more opportunities for social interaction. And so the fact that that is being mandated against, obviously for safety reasons, it's proving quite difficult, especially again post bushfires, when I think our community more now than ever has felt the need to join together and be social. So communities especially are at risk, and this is something more specific, is if you look at some of the demographics, some of these people who are migrants in the area, they've moved by themselves, so they don't actually have a strong link to community, and they can be quite isolated and feel disconnected, as well as, you know, you might be living on a bush block. This isn't the city. So isolation on top of isolation, I think, is just, it's all confounded now, unfortunately.
So how is the Multicultural Centre addressing that? What kind of things are you able to do in a digital space?
Well, Indigo, thank you for asking that brilliant question. I've loved the internet for a long time now, and we at the moment are linking up. So Bega Multicultural Center is part of, we have a network of other multicultural centers. So there's also the Queen Bean Multicultural Center, which I said is my employer, but we also have a center in Goulburn, and there's also one in Cooma. And so we all now are linking together, and we've started a group, so a Facebook group where we can all meet together. So you can join the group, and you can be chatting to people from Goulburn down to Cooma and in Bega over to Queen Bean. So we've extended our network, and now we're also all getting together and brainstorming ideas about how we can offer services online. So one of the things I'm doing, hopefully, is setting up a language exchange to connect people in the community with those who might have knowledge of a language that they'd like to learn.
How does that work?
So we at the moment are just taking an inventory of people interested. So for instance, Indigo, if you wanted to join, you could fill out a survey. So do you have any competency in any languages potentially? I'm sure you do. There's one big one I'm sure you could offer.
Maybe. Well, I was just about to ask that. Are you including English lessons in that?
Of course, because a lot of our clients, they are taking language classes actually through TAFE or online. So if they have someone that they potentially could just do some conversational connecting with online, that would be helpful to them.
Cool.
And not just English, you know, it's Australian night. Like, yeah. I need some Australian lingo classes.
Yeah, absolutely. Awesome. I noticed that on the Facebook page, you've got people actually from places like Iran or Israel or other parts of the world getting in contact with you. I mean, how did that come about?
Okay, so I think one of my most informative experiences in Australia has been through just friends. So I moved to Melbourne in 2009, and I actually came into contact with a really big Iranian group of friends, and through them learned a lot about what it had been like, you know, under the Shah. And my good friend Nasiran, who you saw, she actually became a citizen, an Australian citizen, while I was in Melbourne. I think it would have been in 2011. So I got to see her, you know, go up and get her citizenship and hear about her journey and all that. And so that's really kind of formed my opinions about how important it is to support new migrants and refugees, and how it doesn't just, you know, it's not just one type of experience that all of us, and even myself, have an experience of moving away from home and in some cases, obviously, fleeing war. And so it's just, I think it's really made me see how it hasn't made me feel different. It's actually helped me to connect as a migrant, but also just, yeah, universally, you know, I guess, or world, to feel more worldly, in that we all share these stories. You know, I'm guessing that you, in your history, have family who moved to Australia at some point.
Yeah, sure.
From Germany. There you go. So, yeah, there you go. So, and was that fleeing war?
At that point, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'd need to do some research. Well,
and there we go. I'd love to hear more about your story, because again, I think, especially, and not to generalize, but I think, you know, Australians who, they do have a sense that yes, we did come here, we migrated here, but I think some that we don't hear about that history as much, you know, because now they're just, you get to claim just being Australian, but in truth, most people are migrants to this country. So I think it would be nice to, if we all kind of really embraced our migrant stories.
So then, what do you think was missing from your experience of arriving in Australia and your migrant journey? How much has your experience informed what you have tried to do with this project?
Oh, look, I am so grateful to this country. It's so funny because, again, I'm from America, so and I wasn't fleeing war, but in a way, having moved away, I was. There was kind of an intellectual war being waged, but to be frank, indeed, you know, and an emotional one, in that being a Black American, you kind of feel like a second-class citizen, and you don't realize, because you're told everybody is equal. So, and I did. I had probably a lot more opportunity than most, obviously, have in the world. But at the same time, the breath that I felt, the fresh kind of, it felt like a weight was lifted off my chest when I moved to Australia. And not only just in terms of like being an outsider, I think, and being American, people hear your accent and they kind of treat you differently, but not bad, just, you know, maybe even a little bit better, I don't know, than I would get back home. So I did feel kind of a privilege moving here, but also I was able to, you know, give birth to my first son completely free of charge. That's unheard of in America. You know, you hear about the healthcare premiums and it's just ridiculous. So there was just certain comforts that I really just felt like really happy to have and receive as a permanent resident in this country. So I'm very grateful to this country. But at the same time, I do see, you know, the first job I got when I moved to Melbourne, I worked $12.50 an hour at just a cafe in De Grey Street. And would you believe, Indigo, I thought that, like, that was so much money.
Yeah, it's a huge difference to $2 an hour, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, exactly. So if you know anything about minimum wage in the States, it's like, it's ridiculous. There's no way anybody can, you know, live off that kind of wage. So I thought, oh, wow, I'm making so much money. And here we go. There were backpackers here working, but there were also people from Bangladesh or from Iran, or, you know, places where... and they were only on student visas. So there was a system I did also experience in that privilege, where I saw there is an underclass of migrants as well. And that, you know, that's what happens, I guess, in any country, is that the working class, or, you know, the migrant population kind of gets abused and taken advantage of. So I just feel compelled to let people know that, again, we're all multicultural. And secondly, that anybody can make, you know, a living or a life for themselves in Australia, that everybody's owed the same opportunities.
You've moved nicely into my next question there by saying we're all multicultural. I'm interested. You say multicultural. The first thing that comes in my mind is from a country that speaks a different language. I'm interested then, how much does our First Nations people play a part in this multicultural thing that you're doing?
Oh, look, it's been kind of like, for instance, I'm an English speaker, like, you know, but again, Australian American English is very different. But I feel like culturally I do kind of slot in certain aspects. But one of those aspects that I kind of realized is that, you know, a lot of Indigenous or First Nations cultures and languages, it's not written down. You can't just like go and consult the library, even though there is research into this. So you definitely can. It's a place to start. But I had to just learn by being patient and not trying to force, I think, any ideas that I had about what it means to be an Indigenous person in this community. And so, for me as the multicultural liaison, to assume still even so that I know anything or that I can like force a kind of program, which I think is what I've been noticing happens a lot within these spaces, is that there are well-meaning people who want to work in these spaces, but they themselves have an agenda. And so rather than assume to know or force, my kind of goal, I think, is to do more of a listening and a support role. And again, it's not just for Indigenous people, like it's for anybody. I'm not trying to come in here and force my agenda. Maybe let me be frank. My agenda is just to have fun and connect with community. Like I like to, yeah. That is an agenda I do have. So full disclosure, I want to have a good time. But other than that, like I'm a liaison. So I'm here in a support role. I'm not here in a, you know, dictator role. This is literally me saying this is a resource for everyone. And I made that clear because you might know a bit about the work I've done, but I'm really interested in particular in youth programming. So for me to say, oh, only multicultural youth or migrant youth and whatever people assume that means, like, no, it's for anyone. I've also, because I know that, again, there is that imbalance within our culture of, you know, kind of, not considering Indigenous people as, you know, part of the culture. Again, it's like, it's a bag of worms, isn't it?
Mm.
But I myself have obviously offered dance classes as part of Fling. I did that, and then I started running my own program. I have personal connections with people in community, so that to me is invaluable. And again, I think that the problem is that we assume to know way more than we actually do. And I've only been in the country for 10 years, and they've been in the country for 60,000 years.
So, yeah, yeah.
I like to speak on it, but at the same time, I think it would be great at some point to really heed the voices of our local Indigenous elders and, yeah, support what their projects, because they're doing some amazing things.
Absolutely. I suppose we should talk then about how people might get in contact, how we might find more information about this organization.
Yeah, so you can find us on Facebook at the Bega Multicultural Center if you did a search, and you can also join the Multicultural Hub Support Network group. That's where you can meet with the other hubs, people from the other hubs. So that's one way. You can also just email me at Casey. You know, my name spells a bit strange. CAYCE, and that's at bmc.org.au. So, yeah, reach out.
Casey Hill is the director of the Bega Multicultural Centre, which is located in Auckland Street. And in normal times, you would be invited to go and meet Casey and check out the services that they provide. At this particular point in time, though, of course, we're all in isolation. So check out the Bega Multicultural Centre's Facebook page. Or, as you've just heard, there's an email address there that you can make contact with Casey if you don't have Facebook. Thanks so much to Casey Hill for her time. You are listening to The Local Update, a podcast produced around the Bega Valley, looking at local issues, events and ideas from around the community. My name's Indy Wood, and this podcast produced by Indy Media. indymedia.com.au is the website where you'll find all the info about the podcast and each episode. You can, of course, subscribe on iTunes as well. And if you've got any ideas that you'd like us to share on The Local Update, Indy, I-N-D-I, at indymedia.com.au is the email address. My name's Indy Wood. Thank you so much for your time this week. Bye now.